Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome back to the New Books in Indian Religions podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Raj Balkaran. More importantly, I have the pleasure today of speaking with Dr. Kerry Sanchirico. Probably didn't pronounce that right, but he'll correct me momentarily.
No, that was good. That was good.
We are speaking about a fascinating new OUP publication called Between Hindu and Christian, Christ Bhaktas, Catholics, and the Negotiation of Devotion in Banaras. Kerry, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me, Raj.
You're welcome. As we were navigating the pronunciation of the name, which of course is important in oral cultures, what should have been mentioned is that Kerry's actually Associate Professor of Theology and Religious Studies at Villanova University. So it's great to be able to speak with you today.
Great to speak with you.
So there has to be a backstory to this line of research. You've got to, how did you get interested in this topic? Well, what's esteti Puranas, right? So what's the backstory?
Yeah. So you notice that I have a chapter called Adi Kahania, right?
Oh, yes.
So my backstory is this. In 1993, I had a one-way ticket in hand to go and work for Habitat for Humanity in India. On a three-year tour, okay. Some people joined the Peace Corps. I joined Habitat for Humanity, and that's what got this started for me. Because I ended up finding myself. I lived for 2 years in Haryana, and then a year in Andhra Pradesh. That is now Telangana, actually, and that started me thinking about Hindu-Christian interaction. Yeah, because I was working for a nonprofit that is explicitly Christian, inclusive of other traditions, but it was motivated by Christian faith. That's Habitat for Humanity. That's not often known by people who work with Habitat, but it's more explicit internationally. And inadvertently, this 22-year-old started thinking about these issues of Hindu-Christian interaction, intercultural relations, big facts of colonialism and the residue of it. That never really left me. I went to have formal theological training after those 3 years, and one thing led to another, and eventually I was working on a doctorate. That's sort of the beginning of the backstory, and that's my relationship with South Asia. My interest in religion has always been to help me to understand place, and that place is South Asia, and more particularly, frankly, in the modern world, India.
Yeah. So right before we started recording, Kerry apparently is, he more professionally, but much like me, he's an armchair ethnographer from birth, where he was asking me questions about the podcast. And the podcast, I think your question is, how did this all start up? Well, a note was sent out on one of our academic listservs in 2018 for help with the quote unquote Hindu Studies channel. I inherited it, did about three in 2018, did about maybe 20-ish in 2019, and then the pandemic hit, and this was my war effort to really engage folks who were cooped up so they could talk about their books and also give folks digital content for online courses and just enjoyment, et cetera, et cetera. And I can't even remember when exactly, but shortly thereafter, I rebranded it Indian Religions versus Hindu Studies. And that's meaningful for this conversation because really I'm trying to look at the religious texture across the subcontinent and the diaspora they're from. Precisely for work such as this is why this is called Indian Religions. So what is the, if someone asked you so in an elevator, what's your book about? What's this book about? What would you say?
Yeah, this book is about a religious movement of those we would identify usually as Hindu, usually schedule SCs and OBCs, worshiping Jesus and Mary in Catholic spaces without being baptized. And the fact that they're doing this in a place like Kashi, in Varanasi. That's the interesting thing. And so a little more backstory for this, right? So I arrived, you know, when you want to do religion on the ground, you have to find the ground, very particularly, yeah? And I had been looking for spaces, and Matthew Schmaltz at Holy Cross had done work on Dalit Catholics in the 1990s, and he's been very helpful advisor to me. He said, you should go to Varanasi. I have some contacts there. Maybe there's something there you can find. So I go in 2008, and I meet with the members of the Indian Missionary Society, which is an indigenous Indian Catholic order. And I met them, and in our discussions in Varanasi, I can be even more particular, at Shiva Lagat in Kashi, at one space run by the IMS, they said, have you heard about the Krishna Bhaktas? And me, who has, you know, been studying bhakti, you mean the Krishna Bhaktas? No, the Krishna Bhaktas. The Krishna Bhaktas. What are Krishna Bhaktas? Well, by the Krishna Bhaktas are worshiping Jesus. Interesting. So we go to
fascinating.
Yeah. So that's how it starts. We go to Matra Dham Ashram, which is about 6 kilometers north of the cantonment. And there at Matra Dham Ashram, I was struck by the presence of no less than 6,000 Krishna Bhaktas worshiping Jesus. And the whole project, which became a dissertation and which subsequently, after years of reflection, became the book, was what the hell is going on here? And how best to understand it?
Mm. And without question, I mean, everyone's on the edge of their seat. First of all, they're sort of replaying in their mind. They're you know, the astute listeners, you know, maybe they're washing their dishes, maybe they're running, maybe they're who knows what. But they're like, wait a minute, did this dude just say people doing Christ bhakti in Catholic spaces who aren't baptized? Somebody just, first of all, they're trying to register that. And now, precisely, the purpose of this book is what's on their mind. How do you make sense of that? And there are so many, there are so many directions in which to take the conversation. But let me be a teeny bit formulaic at the outset.
Please.
What are you looking at as your data? What are you studying?
Yeah. So as an ethnographer, what I wanted to do was to chart how people understood how this started, okay? Then I wanted to parse out worldview that I could by way of discourse analysis, and then really trying to understand the lives of people and as they live their lives and as they interpret their lives and what brought them to the ashram and what continues them going with the ashram and what is it to be a bhakta of Yesu in this period of time. How are lives changed? How do they remain the same? And where might all of this be heading in a period of economic liberalization and Hindutva and radical change and globalization?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's been said that India is good to think with. Well, the Krishna Bhaktas are really good to think with, because what they do is they challenge us, just the way you said, my mind is sort of blown by imagining this scene, right? That's where we want to, after your mind gets blown, we want to try to put the pieces back together. How can we best understand? And so the argument is really, if you really want to understand this movement, don't see it as a singular one-off thing. There have been historical precedents. There has been the flames of bhakti have been around the subcontinent. And there is vernacular religion on the ground. There are material conditions, often generally we can say of lack and suffering, and needs are being met through worship. And so we put these different configurations together along with, I would say, charismatic Catholicism, and you have the Krishna Bhakta phenomenon. Not that we could predict it. I don't think we can predict social movements. If X and Y, then this. No, not in that way. But you can see the conditions of possibility whence this movement.
Well, one may not be able to predict what a very inventive, creative chef would do with the ingredients, but once this delicious dish is made, Right. Maybe something that's known or unknown. Maybe no one's ever had paella. They're like, what kind of fried rice is this? Oh, this is not fried. Okay, what? But once you, although it's more than the sum of its parts experientially, clearly you can discern the ingredients.
Right. So I love that analogy, right? Because then we can kind of deconstruct it. Not deconstructing right. to write it off, but deconstructing to understand.
No, account for sort of do inventory of the ingredients, right? The dish is more than the sum of its parts, and there's right. technique there, and there's sort of an experiential dimension there. But nevertheless, there are, you know, there's rice, there's maybe seafood, there may, right. you know, you can discern the sociocultural ingredients that empowered this unique fusion yeah. fare that we're seeing.
Yeah, and that's how we get the masala. You know, that's how we get the various spices together in their own unique singularity, right? So I pay attention a lot to that in this book, maybe tediously.
That's an important point. That's an important point. What would you, let me stay 30,000 foot view for now, and then we'll get into the glorious weeds in a second. What would you most hope folks would take away from this book? Mm-hmm. Or otherwise put, what might this book be arguing positive?
Yeah, I think that one of the things that we see is that this is something that David Chittister writes about in the context of Africa, that really to study religion is to study interreligion. That whether traditions often admit it or not, there are always traces of the other, right? And for me, who has been so wrapped up in Hindu-Christian studies, what is Hindu and what is Christian is hardly a self-evident point. I think that's one of the main arguments, and what I'm trying to demonstrate that. Now, whether I do adequately demonstrate, that's another issue, but that's the aim. That's the aim.
Well, without question, there are those who will ascertain that very point for themselves, particularly folks perhaps using it for their research and teaching. There's a couple of running themes. This might be something along the lines of the 285th podcast on this channel. And so clearly vast majority of the books I look at are out of my niche, and yet they nevertheless draw from the same somewhat syncretic soil of, you know, South Asia. And a couple of the running jokes is that, you know, in all things Indic, as I say, it's never either or. Is it A or is it B? The answer is yes. it's always some form of both. And I think that your particular case study really gloriously sort of illumines this principle. And another running theme that we noticed from study to study is what you said a moment ago about, you know, what is Christianity and as well, what is Hinduism? Would you agree that perhaps that, you know, the latter is a bit more amorphous or elusive to define than the former? Or would you Absolutely. See them as equally? Yes.
No, I think they are. Now I'm going to say and unsay things. Okay. But
good. How apropos.
Yes. So yes, of course, we know the definitional issues around Hindu and Hinduism and Hinduisms is vast. But I will say, and it's easier to find Christianity. It is easier to find Christianity, you know, very often as a system of beliefs and practices creating a moral community around this person, Jesus Christ. Okay, I get it. There's a working definition. Doing it in terms of Hinduism can be certainly more complicated. But having said that, I think that one of the reasons why it seems easier with Christianity is because the category of religion and Christianity grew up together. In other words, Christianity set the terms for what religion properly is. Yes? Now, that's fine. But just like the word Hinduism, once you start to peel that onion, it gets more complicated. Who is a Christian? Who isn't? Who gets to say? Just in those questions, we can start to see it is much more complicated. And if you know history, you know it's a terribly complicated question, because you ask five Christians what constitutes a Christian or Christianity, and you may get 15 answers. Yeah.
One of the brilliant opportunities of this niche, as I see it, is the utter invitation and insistence, the phenomena, the data invites us and insists that we rethink or even abandon or suspend categorization to see what the heck's going on and then go back and revisit our theorization.
Absolutely. We should see, this is the thing. How do we allow the lived religious experience to then shape our categories of understanding? Or exactly. Are categories so reified that we cannot see beyond them? So let me give you an example. So the AAR is coming up, yeah? And one of the panels...
For the generalist audience, the American Academy of Religion. Many may know.
Academy of Religion.
It's an annual conference.
The Conclave of Religion Nerds that will be gathering in San Antonio in November, yeah? So the Society for Hindu Christian Studies, one of the panels is Christianity through Hindu categories, you see? And so when we reverse that gaze and we start playing it the other way, then what sort of things might we notice that heretofore have been obscured? And can you understand Christianity using Hindu categories, or has the category Christ and Christianity been so reified that it can only ever mean one thing, overdetermined? So that's what I'm trying to do in this text, is to shake things up.
Beautiful.
Whether I do that or not is another issue, because one of my concerns about writing this is, in the very trying to undermine certain categories, I'm accidentally reinscribing them. Okay.
Well, so listen, Kerry, the way I see it is this, to be really honest with you, you know, among the intelligent and the thinking, deconstruction's easy. It's effortless. It's easy to fault find and pick apart. My work is certainly not perfect, certainly not a beyond critique, but it's not nothing, nor is yours. It's not nothing. Yeah. And to my mind, the best books are beginnings, right? The best books are positing something somewhat provocative that can, you know, that perhaps invite critique, but also invite rethinking. These people on the ground, why are they offering their devotion to Christ?
Yeah. So this goes back to a prayer meeting that took place in 1992. And this is where the charismatic Catholic story comes. For those who don't know, charismatic Catholicism is a kind of Pentecostalized Catholicism, where there is a heightened emphasis on the working of the Holy Spirit. And that Holy Spirit, Pavitra Atma in Hindi, that Holy Spirit is not just something of the past in the lives of apostles, but is very presently active now. And the word got out of this meeting, and that there were prayers being offered for the sick and those who were suffering. And the story goes that people got healed, and not just Catholics. Look, this is a very small Catholic population in North India. Okay. And so people got healed, and they needed a place to go after this prayer meeting. So move into 1993, 94, they start to meet at Matra Dham Ashram, and a prayer meeting is happening on a regular basis. People are starting to come to this ashram, this Catholic ashram, and more people are getting healed, and they are telling their friends, and they are telling their friends, and so it goes. And that's how the word got out. And the ashram, the space itself, has developed to meet the needs of those devotees over time. Very particularly, like the pavilion that was built, the open air pavilion, was a piecemeal effort. Started in one place, then some more money came in, and they built it larger, and they built it larger, and they built it larger, so that now underneath this pavilion, about 8,000 people can be standing or sitting, which is what they do.
Can you tell us a bit about what else these folks are doing in terms of their religiosity, or who else they may be worshiping, type thing?
Sure. Now this is a touchy information, because you know that Abrahamic traditions are not so keen on worshiping, well, non-Christian deities in Christianity. And what I found, if I could use the metaphor of center and periphery, the closer you got to the center of this movement, the more exclusive worship of Jesus became. Yeah. For many, in the ashram itself, those who stroll in casually on a second Saturday, there are many there for whom Jesus is a superhuman being like others that can give some sort of boon. The deeper you go into the movement, the more exclusive it becomes, so that those devotees are no longer worshiping, say, the big gods, particularly of Shiva or Krishna, or the goddess. That is not, however, uniform. And one finds that in the regular day-to-day life, you could still have Krishna Bhaktas who go and visit the local Dibaba, right? The local Gramadeva, the local village deity, and do some propitiation, and then move on about their daily lives. But what I found was the further you go in to the movement, the more exclusive devotion becomes.
Tell us a bit about the baptism piece or lack thereof. Is there a tension there for anyone?
Absolute tension, because for traditional Christianity, baptism is the entry point into the faith, you know, for most. And that will follow, depending on the Christian tradition, there will be sacraments that are followed throughout one's life, in a similar way that some scars might follow a Hindu through his or her life. And this will travel from cradle to grave. And if you're in the Catholic and Orthodox tradition, you'll have prayers for the dead, for example. Obviously, not so much in evangelical or the Protestant world. And so the interesting thing is that they are not being baptized. And in lieu of that, what's happening is that other means of communication between devotee and deity have been negotiated. That's the negotiation piece. Okay. And there's different reasons, stated reasons for not baptizing. We can get into that if you like. Okay.
Absolutely.
So there's listeners might find this interesting, because there is always a sense that Christian missionaries are eager to baptize all comers. The priests and nuns who often minister to Krishna Bhaktas have a real fear that baptism will, in fact, hurt the faith of the Krishna Bhakta. That is, their faith will become, to use the language of Weber, routinized. And these will simply become run-of-the-mill, nominal Catholics with no real living faith in Jesus Christ. So in lieu of that, and this is the real charismatic part of this movement, they would much rather have people have a living relationship with Yesu than having the formal sacraments administered and everything being done by the book. Mm. That's a new thing in the Catholic tradition, instead of like of the resistance to baptism. You know, let's not be hasty here and make sure that a lot of learning has gone on and catechesis. Well, that's very different than, say, what took place in Latin America in the 15th and 16th, 1700s, for example, just to show how different it is, okay? Now, the other big fact of the matter is that baptizing thousands of OBCs and SCs in this period of time during Hindu nationalist ascendance is quite literally dangerous. And so there is, you know, the theological and spiritual message that's given, hey, let's not ruin these people, which is interesting. And coupled with the big fact that just down the street is the local branch of the Shiv Sena. So that's the everyday reality. And in light of that reality, indigenous practices have formed by which Krishna Bhaktas commune with Yesu in new, and we could argue, well, Hindu ways, you know.
The invoking the healing phenomenon of the sort of the genesis of this movement, regarding the power, the force, the spiritual power, is it understood at all through a Hindu theological lens or lenses, or how is that power understood?
Well, I think that we have a change or a transformation that takes place over time. And this is always an interesting thing about the word that is, again, overdetermined, which is conversion. Yeah. Very often, you know, you cannot come to, no one comes to the ashram with a blank slate. They all have their preconceived theologies and philosophies that have developed over time, bequeathed over thousands of years. And so when Like when Jesus is encountered by many, he has done so as a super mundane being that has certain powers. Is he understood to be the very ground of being in traditional Catholic or Christian theology? No. This may develop over time, however. This may develop over time. One other interesting thing, Raj, about the Krishna Bhaktas and the devotional vocabulary of Yesu Bhakti has been, if you have ears to hear, you can hear the Vaishnavism behind it. You can hear it.
Perfect. So tell us a bit more about that, please.
Well, I think, you know, Christianity gets to North India pretty late in the story, in the devotional story. And the devotional vocabulary has been provided. And indigenization projects of the Catholic Church over the last, well, specifically 60 years, has been very open to using that vocabulary. You know, the language is the language of devotion, which I include in my book where I really parse out words that are used, right? And moods and motivations that are elicited, which sound very much like the language, say, of Mirabai. Or you could even hear the language of Surdas there as well. Hat tip to Jack Hawley, etc. And other scholars of Bhakti in North India. You hear it alive and well. You hear a word like Jagdish, right? You hear a word like Muktidata. And so I've tried to pay close attention to those words, right? Because one could go in and not have any knowledge and say, oh, this is just a Christian revival meeting. If you don't know the language, right? But then in everyday parlance, you could say, well, that's just a sort of top-down that the priests have used on these devotees. But they use it among themselves. They don't need to be taught how to worship God. I mean, particular forms. But this is where I think the category of bhakti actually crosses, right? Crosses religious traditions over and over and over again. And we are remiss if in all of our discourse on bhakti in South Asia, we do not also include what we would identify as Christian forms of bhakti. And this has been made very strongly, this case, on Islam. And I think we also need to extend the boundaries also to Yesu bhakti as well.
That's fascinating for so many reasons. The extent to which the idiom of bhakti and its ability to span or even assimilate various objects of devotion. I remember when I was, I immigrated to Toronto very young. I was 3 years old and probably understandably so I was, although Toronto is now the world's most diverse city statistically. I was very sheepish and embarrassed of my culture because, you know, it's difficult fitting in, blah, 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 blah. You get the idea. But I remember driving past this local Roman Catholic Church community, Italian community. And there's this, maybe about a mile or two from where I lived, one of the main streets in Toronto. And there was this glorious white statuette of Mother Mary. Mm-hmm. In front of the church. And I remember it was a Sunday. I had I was able to see Christians, Catholics, bring flowers to the bust of Mother Mary and offer them. And I remember thinking to myself, oh my God, they do that too. Yes. Oh my God, they do that too. It was one of these moments where I was like, what's happening here? So, you know, on the one hand, you know, this the Indic idiom of bhakti certainly one can assimilate a variety of objects of devotion to that, and also there seems to be perhaps even something cross-cultural about the need to hold as an object of devotion whatever one is worshiping. So I find that fascinating. So tell us a little bit about, if you can, the worldview of these Christ Bhaktas with respect to, in particular, samsara.
Ah, very good. Yes. Well, this is something that, as so much of this might be coming across of me not wanting to come down too strongly. I want to be careful. The Christ Bhaktas most definitely live in an enchanted universe with various demigods and deities and sub-deities and apsars and devas and shaitans. That's all very real. Okay? That's all very real. We should also note that many Christian Indians believe in a kind of reincarnation.
Okay?
And that means Christians who have been Christian for generations. And I think with the Krishbhaktas, we see a sort of in-between space where some people see them as, when they die, going to be with Jesus immediately, and others more circuitously. But that's a work in progress, and that's more work that I need to do, right? I still think that karma theory is still alive and well for Krishbhaktas. I hear it in the discourse, you know? And this is always the fascinating thing about trying to take apart that paella that you referred to. I think the most important thing, this isn't necessarily a pie in the sky after you die kind of theology. It does have with Pentecostalism a certain amount of prosperity gospel attached. I would say a kind of soft prosperity gospel, that this God and God's nature wants to bless you, and that one of the signs of that blessing is material improvement. But that our living relationship is at least beginning in this life, and that it will continue on into the next life.
Mm. Yeah. Fascinating. Part of why that's so fascinating is this modern phenomenon of a variety of individuals who variously identify as Christian, Jewish, spiritual, but not religious, who really resonate with karmic theory. And even in the modern age, even in the Western world, don't see it as mutually exclusive. I find that fascinating, particularly in my continuing studies teaching. Most of my teaching these days is continuing studies, adult learners, lifelong learners. It's fascinating. Well, I
think there are certain resonances with parts of Christianity on this, like this, the very notion of you reap what you sow. So the question of, to what extent is that the case?
You know? For how long? For how long are you reaping? For one life, for many.
Right. And for how long? And one could be worshiping a deity and understand that samsara will continue with you in relationship to that deity for ages unto ages. Yeah. And again, Mira comes to mind for that immediately to me.
So you had the opportunity, or you created the opportunity, to sort of digest and reflect and incubate your ideas between dissertating and publishing the book. Mm-hmm. I was a bit of the opposite in that I defended in 2015, and then 2016, I just had to figure out how to support myself as an independent scholar. We all know what the job market is like. And then, long story short, I opted to remain independent to wait out the election cycle. And by the other side of that, I was like, oh, wait a minute, I can do what I want to do working for myself. So great. But the first book came out 2018. So it's fairly short between dissertating and reflecting. And then in many ways, I imagine there was lots of change in your perspective and thinking. And could you tell us a little bit about that gestation process?
It's a great question. There were a lot of factors in the distance between the dissertation and the final product. And one of them was sheer practicality. I was right on the cusp of everything going to pot as far as jobs go, right? While I was in grad school, the economic crisis, the downturn of 2009 happened. And that's when I received my funding to go overseas. So it was a good place to be in that year. And there were still jobs when I went on the job market in 2011 and 2012. And I was really taken up with the work, first at the University of Hawaii and now at Villanova University, with the work of being a young scholar in a department. And getting involved in at least one other project, I ended up co-editing a work called Hagiography and Religious Truth, which took time. I did some other writing as well. And I have three children, a wife and three children, and that took time. And also, I wasn't satisfied. I had a lot more translations that I wanted to do. I have hours and hours of translation, never made it into this book, and that takes time. And I really just wanted to keep reflecting on it. And I got the contract with OUP. It took them a while to give me a response back. And I wasn't in a rush because I had other things to do and I was moving towards completion, and then COVID hit and that changed everything. So suddenly I was not thinking about this book. Yeah.
And the world changed.
The world changed. Yeah. And we're still dealing with that. And I hope we spend more time reflecting on it. So that explains the gestation, the long gestation period. But an interesting part of having, you know, making the sausage is there are parts of this book that are quite old, and there's parts that are much newer. Now the reader won't know that.
But yeah, exactly. So I'm sort of hoping to peek behind the curtain and wonder what did that opportunity afford you?
Well, it afforded me a time to keep growing up with the and thinking with the Chris Buck does. And India was changing. And India is changing. And it's not the same. During my time, the prime minister changed, and that's Prime Minister Modi. And guess where he is elected out of? Varanasi. Yeah. So the electricity has never been better. And in Kashi as it is now. There are certain things that have changed in Varanasi. And vote banks have changed. For example, the Chris Bhaktas are OBCs and SCs. And as it happens, OBCs tend to back not just the BJP, but can be quite popular with OBCs. Yeah. And that's an interesting thing, right? Because it's a Hindu nationalist party with these people who are worshiping Jesus and working it out, you know? Some people would call them converts, though certainly within the boundaries of the Indian constitution, they are still considered Hindu. They cannot be considered Christian either by the constitution because they are not baptized. And so see, they fall outside the typical categories, and their political views may also not be what we particularly expect. So in that sense, Raj, they're good to think with. And so I continue to do that. And I don't know, you know, I don't know what will happen to the Chris Bhaktas. In one of my final chapters, I sort of offer some dangerous prognostications, as they call them. I'm not sure what will happen. I have some ideas what will happen to this movement, but I hope to spend the rest of my life thinking through it with them.
It's lovely. It's so rich to have, inspiring to have a topic that can capture one's academic scholarly interest for, you know, it's a long shelf life. Was there anything else about the book that you hope we touch on, you that you wanted to say?
Well, I just want to know that I do spend some time thinking about place and the development of space and what it means. I use some categories helpfully given to us by Robert Orsi about abundant people. And I apply that to places like Varanasi and Matradam Ashram and trace their development, how they get roots in a place and the phenomenological and noumenal encounters that are understood to be there. That's one thing that I try to play with. I used Tanya Lorman talking about spiritual kindling and what is being attempted in the prayers very often of Chris Bhaktas and ministers to Chris Bhaktas, and trying to kindle faith in people, to bring about faith, and to introduce a new sort of framework of existence of how they see the world. That's another thing that I do. And I provide, and this was a kind of a challenge for this book, is how do you pitch a book that is called Between Hindu and Christian to the reading public or to scholars? Because some will say, well, this has, you know, is this a Hindu studies book? Is it a Christian studies book? And I say, yes, but that makes for just not just a long book, but lots of parenthetical references, you know, and that can get tedious for people. But I found myself like, I have to explain what this word means. I have to explain what this word means, you know, to this group, I have to explain this. To this other group, I have to explain this other thing. And that was a real challenge to this type of work. Any sort of comparative work or interreligious work is a minefield for that, because you want to be just to all parties and everything in between.
No small feat, without question. There was a recent, recently covered on the podcast. I think it was Hindu Christian dual belonging. Fascinating, yeah. Related work, and there've been a number of works. And for the podcast, it's great because this, of course, will appear on the channel that I host, primarily Indian Religions. But without question, this will also appear on New Books in Christian Studies, among other relevant channels. And that sort of, to my mind, that's more of a feature than a bug to this sort of scholarship.
Yes, no.
So,
and I'm a big fan of the people who wrote that book that you just cited. Even though I can't wait to read it. I am looking forward.
Fantastic. So I believe I answered your question about sort of the podcast taking off at the outset of our podcast today. But I will pass the baton because I appreciate the joy and the interest in asking people questions that you obviously have, and that I joked 1,000 times, I have no idea how I'm not an ethnographer. I mean, as a scholar, I study texts. So I'll pass the baton. Is there anything else that you had wanted to ask before we close of me?
Well, I think what I'd like to ask is, because you have your ear to the ground, so to speak, what are the trends that you're seeing in scholarship on India?
That is a great question that I actually should devote some thought to, because it's, as I say, I've had nearly 300 podcast experiences, and there's no, contrary to what a very small percentage of our colleagues think or feel or assume, there is no agenda or mandate. I have, anyone who's producing scholarship on South Asian studies, Indic religions, from credible presses, I have on the podcast, regardless of their methodology or their niche. So there's a variety of areas. So nothing, to my knowledge, is left out. And if it is, it certainly isn't intentional. One of the things that I see more and more of is a scholarship that really tries to grapple with the experience of adherence, the pious, the religious, in a way that I think there's a particular phenomenon of the scholar practitioner that we've talked about. But whether or not one is a scholar practitioner, I really feel that one of the strands that I see is scholarship that really takes seriously. Obviously, we operate from an Edic paradigm necessarily. This is what the production of Act of Knowledge is about, but nevertheless, taking seriously the perspective of emic experiences only helps us to be better scholars. Obviously, it goes without saying, provided we don't fall prey to, shoddy scholarship or et cetera, right? But I see that's one trend. And I think the feature, not bug, of your scholarship in terms of scholarship that is touching on a number of subfields or methodologies, I see that as definitely a trend that I've noticed. But that's a really good and fascinating question. I should really have a think consciously at some point, look over the works.
Hopefully that helps. I say that because, we are constantly bombarded by data, and new books. And there's no way that we all can keep up. And you're in a unique position because of the cross that you bear. To really, you like that?
Yeah. The heaviness of the crown.
The heavy is the head that wears your crown, Raj. That you're just in a place to say, these are the trends. This is what I'm seeing. This is what people are thinking of. These are popular theorists. These are people that are being neglected. These are things that we are not talking about. And then you can always ask the why question.
Yeah. And also I've seen some really fascinating straddling of textual studies and ethnography, which I think, ideally probably is the way to go for all things Indic. But it would really just a heightened awareness of cultural context around texts and the way they interplay, which I think is fascinating and important. Certainly there are trends in Purana studies that I've noticed because that's my particular niche, and we are endeavoring to perhaps change the course of the ways in which the piranhas were originally received by early colonial scholars as, you know, bastardized texts that shifted here and there and didn't have the fixity of the Vedic revelations, for example. So, you know, those trends I'm more attuned to, because when I operate as podcast host, Scholar Raj is in the background, but he's in the back seat. He's in the back seat. He may kind of whisper in my ear every once in a while, but I don't listen to him too much. It's sort of, I'm focusing my attention on this work and not bringing up other people's work or other podcasts, you know. And so I try to just spotlight that work. I mean, I could have guest A and then guest B is their nemesis, and nobody would know from the conversation. I'm just focusing on the work being produced as a service to our field and the public. But the question you asked really is fascinating. And I think I'm actually going to give us some thought and look over some of these podcasts and see what I'm noticing.
Yeah, I could give you some work to do as professor, right?
If I was good.
I would say this. What you need to do is, after every year that you complete it, you do a big think on this and you do a podcast dedicated to trends in the books that you have covered.
You know what? That sounds like a fascinating idea, because I've been thinking more and more on the meta level of not just the content of the books. One thing that I can comment on sort of in the moment, aside from the actual content, because, you know, you do hundreds of books and you know, you'd have to really sit and get all squinty and remember what is where. But one thing I will say is, regarding the application, regarding the podcasting enterprise itself, the world has changed. I was working from home on Zoom, teaching online in 2017. I had no freaking idea what I was doing until 2020. And then my colleagues, who are all profs for the most part, some baristas, but most profs, were like, oh, this, they were knocking on my door in 2020 for obvious reasons. So one thing I will say is, I sensed an opportunity to serve with the podcast without question. But the extent to which it has become relatively integrated into academic enterprise is beyond my wildest dreams. Some profs and students to the podcast for research purposes. It's listed on CVs. You know, people use it to keep up with what's being published, because, you know, someone else does the heavy lifting of looking on all the publishers' websites. There's a formal affiliation now with Religions of South Asia, with a couple of the AR groups. And so that was beyond my wildest dreams. I held a reception at Denver last year at the AR, and I thought, what on earth is going on? I mean, it's sort of, because I'm in my little home office here in Midtown Toronto, where I teach at a variety of spaces, including the OCHS, and I'm in a little black box. But really, I mean, when I take a look at the ways in which this podcast in particular has infiltrated the field, it's definitely beyond what I could have anticipated, frankly.
I think you figured out that you met a need that we didn't know we had, you know?
Yeah.
I think it's a real benefit, and I really appreciate the work that you're doing in new books and religion, et cetera. Because it's just a way to extend the discourse. Give it to our students to ruminate on. Hey, go listen to this podcast. This is very helpful. This particular point, focus on this, and we can bring it back and talk about it.
And also, the nuts and bolts are there. The nuts and bolts are there for the specialists, right? But this, what the podcast does is, it keeps it at the conversational level for accessibility, so that anybody who's remotely interested can decide whether or not they want to dive into that level of discourse. And ironically, sometimes even keeping it at that 30,000 foot level, 30,000 foot view level, where purposely naive questions are asked, it actually forces us to really think about the ramifications. So what's your book about? So why is this important? So, are these people Hindu or not? Those seemingly naive questions. And they often come from students, actually. But they really, I think they invite and even coerce us to think about the implications of what we're doing beyond the nitty gritty.
And that's why it's such an important thing to be able to teach, because it stays out of this hothouse of intellectual scholar speak.
Fascinating. So, I have passed the baton and I will take that baton back to close. I hope that I've sated your ethnographic appetite for one day.
Never.
All right. Well, then we'll have to continue. And I like that idea of a podcast, whether it's annually, a podcast episode about the podcast. I love that idea. And while I naively didn't anticipate what the podcast could be, apparently, you know, Marshall Poe, the editor-in-chief of New Books Network, he's a bona fide visionary. He saw this. This is his hope. Yes. You know, for these various subject specific podcasts. So I thought, wow, without question, he's a visionary, which is really cool. So we are about time for today. So thank you very much for appearing on the podcast.
It's been my pleasure.
For those listening, of course, we've been talking to Kerry San Chirico.
You got it.
On Between Hindu and Christian, Christ Bhaktas, Catholics, and the Negotiation of Devotion in Benares, the Varanasi, the Holy City. Until next time, keep well, keep listening, keep contemplating the usefulness or uselessness of religious categories. And also keep contemplating the power of podcasts. Take care.
Take care. Thank you.